Kelly.
All right, first matter we have on calendar this morning. Docket number 69074, Lacey versus District Court in the State. How are you?
Good morning, I'm fine. Good morning. Thank you. I can proceed.
Would you like to reserve a little time?
I would like to reserve 3 minutes if I could, Your Honor.
Certainly.
At the end for rebuttal. Freddie Forsman on behalf of the petitioner, Lacey Thomas. The heart of the jurisprudence of the double jeopardy clause, and particularly in this setting where it's a bar to a retrial after a mistrial, is to protect the defendant against harassment, embarrassment, and risk of successive prosecutions. That runs through all of the cases. This case is really the greatest example of overreaching and harassment that you might ever see. Lacey Thomas was recruited to come to Nevada in 2004 to head up UMC. I'm not going to go through all the facts, but I think that there's some factual underpinnings of the legal issue with regard to the overreaching that occurred here. In 2008, the prosecutor secured an indictment against him for honest services, which is the Nevada version of honest services fraud, and fraud counts, in a case in which there were no kickbacks, there was no personal gain, there was no unjust enrichment of Mr. Thomas. Basically, as the trial court judge described, he was being indicted for a felony for a determination by the prosecutor that contracts that were entered into it's hard to describe, frankly, because the theory of the state was so unusual and mushy. The best thing I can tell you is what happened during the trial when the trial court asked the prosecutor, if hiring someone who couldn't handle the job is criminal, wouldn't that turn a bad business decision into a felony? And because the prosecutor's theory on counts 1 and 6 was that there were already people in the county doing the work, apparently unsatisfactorily, and that Mr. Thomas brought in people that he knew from his prior job as the administrator of Cook County Hospital in Chicago. Now, I cannot leave here without emphasizing that race was injected into this case from the very beginning. The prosecutor made sure that the grand jury knew that Lacey Thomas is black. The prosecutor made sure that the grand jury knew that several of the contractors that he entered into contracts with were black. So as the case proceeded to trial, and that was in 2008, the indictment came down. 2010, after 10 days of trial, 13 to 15 witnesses had already testified, a mistrial was declared because a binder, and it's the easiest way to refer to it, a binder full of exculpatory material determined to be exculpatory by the trial court judge and determined to be so prejudicial that there was no remedy other than a mistrial. After that much time, believe me, any trial judge is going to be reluctant to declare a mistrial, but it was so obvious.
Who made the motion for the mistrial?
The defendant made the motion for the mistrial. He was forced into the motion for the mistrial by the time they got it, and that's where the rule... That's what implicates the rule with regard to whether or not the bar.
Were they goaded into a mistrial?
And yes, absolutely, because the failure to turn over the material, at that point, after they had already cross-examined the witnesses, the trial court judge found, and we of course agreed, that there was no remedy of going back and re-cross-examining the witnesses now that we have this binder full of material. The very critical point...
You would contend that this case is entirely controlled by Oregon versus Kennedy?
I think we meet either Oregon versus Kennedy or the rules that have been adopted by those states that have varied from Oregon versus Kennedy. And as you know,
the district court didn't find an intentional.
Found it not intentional, and I have to tell you.
And we're stuck with that finding unless it's clearly erroneous, right?
I believe that even under Oregon versus Kennedy, you could make an intentional finding and find that the trial court's judgment, although I rarely would ask you to do that, was clearly erroneous because the objective facts and circumstances, and that's what Oregon versus Kennedy calls for, is looking at the objective facts and circumstances. And you have undisputed facts in this case that the police officer, and during the hearing, it was Detective Ford took the binder, it was on a disc at first, but then it turned into a binder, took the binder, gave it to Deputy District Attorney Scott Mitchell, gave it to him, talked to him about it, and then when the prosecutor indicted on counts 1 and 6, which was the most relevant, the materials most relevant to, he testified that he went back to Scott Mitchell because he was concerned because the cops had recommended against indicting on those counts.
Of course,
so took it back.
I may have asked this in the previous oral argument, but I wanted to again cover this ground. Returning to the district court's finding that there was no intent here, I struggle, and I want the state to address this too. I struggle to understand how the district court could make that finding when Mr. Mitchell never testified.
I agree, and I think that in the last several days I've been looking for a case that comes up in this posture and haven't found one, but the closest thing would be the inference that you can make. There's even an inference for a defendant if a defendant doesn't answer direct allegations, even though the burden of proof is not on the defendant, that there is an inference found to be constitutional, and certainly it can be applied to the state. Why didn't they call Scott Mitchell? They've never said why they didn't call him. They had a police officer saying, I talked to him. I told him it was exculpatory. I didn't agree with counts 1 and 6. Here's the stuff. And we don't
know. You would argue that there's a negative inference from the failure to produce evidence presumptively within the state's control.
That would be the rule, Your Honor. That would be the rule. Particularly when there's, I think then it becomes particularly poignant when there's a direct allegation. He got it. And so if they're unable to explain that, I think that you could overturn. You could, as we've talked about before the panel, Nevada law is not exactly clear on this standard to be used. Although post Oregon versus Kennedy, it appears that we have an excusable or inexcusable negligence standard, and that's our allegation that the judge used the wrong standard in making the finding. But I believe that this case comes to you in such an unusual posture, in such need of judicial intervention to protect this defendant.
Time's going. I wanted you to cover another area. The exculpatory information that was not produced dealt with count 1 on the ACS contract. The question that resides, I think, with us is whether even if one concludes that this case fits within Oregon or whether you apply Nevada's jurisprudence, which is a little bit broader on double jeopardy, why should it be applied to the remaining counts that, or at least those counts that do not deal with ACS?
If the trial judge had only mistried those counts, possibly that's where we would be. But that's not what happened. What the trial judge found was that the failure to turn this evidence over basically prejudiced the remainder of the trial. Basic double jeopardy law is
Could you cite maybe one or two examples of how, I read that, where there was some influence on the rest of the trial because some witnesses would not have been able to be appropriately cross-examined by the time this information had come forward. But could you give an example or two of how the inability to cross-examine or the inability to have that information impaired the defendant or prejudiced the defendant's ability to deal with the other counts?
Let me just go with what the trial judge who was sitting there said. And what he said was we have now had 13 witnesses. It may have been as many. The trial judge said 13 to 15. I didn't go back and try to count them. But 13 to 15 witnesses which have testified to the course of dealing of Mr. Thomas with the vendors. And that the trial judge found that he could not separate out the basic theory of the state as it ran through that indictment. It ran through the rest of the indictment as well. So the failure to adequately cross-examine the ACS witnesses would affect the jury in the remainder of the proceedings. They couldn't unring the bell. He also found that it would be unreasonable and unfair to allow the state to recess, come back in, and then try to recross it, because all the witnesses would be prepared. But here's the real point, is that that's not what the trial judge did. I suppose he could have tried to could have knocked off a couple of the counts and then proceeded with the rest, but he didn't do that. And because he didn't do that, and because jeopardy attached at the time that the jury was sworn, basic double jeopardy law is that it's the successive prosecution that's the issue, not how many witnesses have testified on any particular count. And that's why the whole that's why the whole successive prosecution cannot go forward the second time. There is a second issue here, and I know the court has been. Let me go back. The panel asked me, and I don't think I did a very good job with it. The panel asked me what rule I would adopt. I would have you adopt, and so I went back through to look. And one of the most interesting cases is what the Oregon Supreme Court did when Kennedy came back to Oregon. The Oregon Supreme Court said, "Okay, we respect you, Supreme Court, but we're gonna carve out a little extra room here." So the Oregon rule is, it's improper prejudicial conduct that is so prejudicial that it can't be cured short of a mistrial, which is what the trial judge found. Prosecutor knows that the conduct is improper and prejudicial. The prosecutors know that it's improper to withhold information. You've got undisputed facts that he had the information, didn't turn it over. And we also showed through the order of Judge Hagen in 2004, decades of Brady violations by this prosecutor's office. And the prosecutor either intends, and here's where the carve-out is, intends or is indifferent to the resulting mistrial or reversal. Either intends or is indifferent. In other words, the cavalier attitude, oh, we'll just mistry the case, leave Mr. Thomas's life and career on hold while we do it, and then we'll just go back and retry the case. That's indifferent to the double jeopardy rights of the defendant. Oregon follows that rule. Arizona follows that rule. New Mexico is close to that rule. and then there's several other, Hawaii, I've cited most of them in my brief. There's several other states that have something that will just even more nebulous, which is it's whether or not he was deprived of a fair trial with no standards whatsoever. But Oregon and Arizona seem to actually give you something to get your teeth into to say at least it doesn't have, you don't have to prove intent to go somebody into a mistrial, you give yourself extra room. Although, as I say, I think we meet that standard if you look at it objectively on the very unusual posture of this case, since they decided not to explain at all why the known exculpatory material wasn't turned over. I'm sorry, Your Honor, do I have 2:46 left, or is that my rebuttal?
Yes, you do.
Before rebuttal, I still have rebuttal time.
Actually, that is your rebuttal.
Okay, I think what I'd like to do is stop at this point then and reserve that for my rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Morning. May it please the Court, all justices. I understand the focus that appears that the court is going to, and I will try to address that. One of the questions I think was raised last time, and I think goes to a lot of the arguments that have been made, or at least the questions coming from the court thus far, were some sort of test in this case. I think I can articulate that, but I would like to go first to talk a little bit about Oregon versus Kennedy, Melchor Gloria, and Hylton, which I think are the cases that the court is sort of utilizing and coming up with decisions about whether double jeopardy applies to a particular case or not. I think the threshold determination in any case where a court is considering to apply double jeopardy to the counter to the case itself is, first, there has to be a determination as to how the mistrial occurred and who requested it. That is the threshold determination. Whether it was the court sua sponte, whether it was the prosecutor or the state, rather, or whether it was the defense. If it was the prosecutor or it was the court sua sponte, then I think the Hylton decision is primarily controlling for how this court would handle that. The Kennedy versus Oregon versus Kennedy decision did not really address the issue of a prosecutor or court issued or ordered mistrial in a particular case. It focused almost entirely on a defense requested mistrial. In this case, that's what we had. We had the defense requesting mistrial. Now, the court made some findings of manifest necessity, but that was the finding that the court was asked, was there a motion? A motion was brought forth by the defense. The defense brought the motion for mistrial and articulated reasons why they wanted the mistrial. This was on day 10 of the trial after this issue had come up on day 9 of the trial. So if we move to that range, we don't get to the Heilton analysis, which is the first part of the Heilton analysis, which is manifest necessity. Was there actually manifest necessity, making a determination that that was the case? Did the judge articulate circumstances by which it should occur? Did the judge's findings or what the judge stated, was it supported in some way by the record?
Was there resistance by the state to the motion for mistrial?
In this particular case, absolutely.
And what was the basis of the resistance? And did they want to carve out, did the prosecutor want to carve out some counts or anything?
We offered multiple alternatives at least a couple of different instances in the case. First of all, in admitting the entire booklet wholesale was offered as because the defense already had the booklet. They'd had it for days. They had then been attempting to introduce it into evidence themselves. And it was at that point that we didn't know what this booklet was, and we were trying to ferret out what was going on, and that's when it all came out that this had been something that the police had been given years before. So initially we indicated that the whole book can come in. We also said we would recall any witness that it was still our case in chief. We hadn't relinquished the case at that point. We would recall any witness for cross-examination by the defense based on what the contents of the booklet were, if we needed to. We offered to carve out those counts, just proceed on the remaining counts, which did not include ACS. There were 5 contracts, 4 of which had absolutely nothing to do with ACS. The one count that remained after this court dismissed count 1 was the misconduct count. That had nothing to do with the booklet or the contract itself, other than essentially Mr. Thomas's actions after the contract came into being, basically his own actions which altered the existence of the contract at the time. So carving out the contract was another alternative that the state recommended. We opposed it. We said there could be a continuance. I don't know how many more alternatives there could be that we offered to the court, and the court felt that none of those alternatives were reasonable. I'm sorry, forgot to say something. So in that sense, the state's, and that's another part that's important, is that depending on who requests the continuance, the burden is on one side versus the other. If the state requests it, or the court sua sponte orders a mistrial, then the burden is upon the state, and it's a stiff burden. Oregon versus Kennedy states that. That it's a stiff burden on the prosecution to justify the mistrial and then the retrial in the face of that mistrial. If it's the defense, almost, then the defense is essentially the one with the burden. And it's really not a bar to mistrial unless an exception applies. Now, Oregon versus Kennedy specifically said that there was one very narrow exception. And they made it very clear that it was a very narrow exception. The concurrence opinion in the judgment, but the concurrence with that was, I think there were 4 justices that signed on to it, said that they believed that it should be broadened to include the overreaching component and so forth. As far as the Supreme Court, though, in Oregon versus Kennedy, for what they decided, all the justices determined that because there was essentially not an intentional act, the actions that brought forth the mistrial in the first place, even though the defense asked for it, didn't rise to that level of something that they would consider to be overreaching or whatever. They didn't have to get to those arguments, but they took it upon themselves to carve that out. Now, one thing that's important to note, Oregon versus Kennedy, there have been 90 opinions on Oregon versus Kennedy since it came in, which actually discuss in any detail that decision. Of those, 4 criticize the opinion and 1 does not follow it. That's the Poole decision, which is cited in the materials before the court. The vast majority of the jurisdictions hold Oregon versus Kennedy in the circumstances by which it came forward. This court, in going forward with Melchor Gloria, also followed the same line and cites to Oregon versus Kennedy. Heilton does not cite to Oregon versus Kennedy directly at all, maybe tangentially through a case that is cited by Oregon versus Kennedy in the decision. But I would submit to you that the rule that should be in place is the step one analysis is that the court should make a determination which side requested the mistrial, and if it was the state or the court, then the analysis that Heilton went through where Nevada has expanded or kept the expansion would be the appropriate one to go forward.
Can you exonerate the Scott Mitchell for not supplying this information to the defense?
Well, let me go address that, because I think Justice Hardesty went back and talked about the issue of how it could be that the state had this information and didn't provide it or whatever that was. This is in the record, and it's in petitioner's appendix, pages 56 to 57 and also 97. In 97, page 97, there's a reference to this. In November, 5 months before trial, I came into the case as a co-prosecutor, essentially. At that time, I went through all the discovery that we had in the office. This book was not contained in that discovery. But in going through the discovery and reading the police report, there were references to transcripts, you know, recorded interviews, things like that, and I didn't see transcripts. So I went back to the police and I said, look, where are these? Do we have these? They said they can produce them to us. They may have been produced to us in the past. It was not part of the physical file that we had. I don't have an explanation for why we didn't have this at the time. When I talked to Mr. Albrecht, he didn't have them either. So at the time, I gathered all of those materials together, presented them to the defendant, or the defense. The trial gets set out, and out of an abundance of caution, ask Metro to bring over all of the supporting documents, aside from the things obviously that are involved, but all the supporting documents that went to the submission. They brought over a series of banker's boxes of materials, including, we didn't make these legends, but the police had made legends of what was contained in all of the banker's boxes of all of the material that was part of the original submission to our office. Defense counsel got copies of all of those materials. At the time the mistrial was declared, actually, I had gone back, I was charged to go back that night to look through all of our materials, to look through the legends, because I couldn't answer the court at that time as to whether or not that book had ever been part of the discovery we had and if it had never been turned over. So I went back, could not find it in any of the legends that the police supplied to us as to the materials that were contained in the submission packet, so to speak, and supplied those legends to the court. So from the state's perspective, we physically didn't have it. Now, is it possible that it came to our office? I mean, I know that Detective Whiteley said he didn't remember it, didn't think that material was presented. Detective Ford said that he thought that it would have been, he thinks it should have been, he would likely remember doing it. When I asked him specifically if he had knowledge or recollection that it had actually turned this material over to Scott Mitchell, he said no.
Well, and that didn't the district court find that the police, Metro, turned that over
yes.
to your office? The district court made a factual finding yes. to that effect.
Yes. The only reason I'm addressing that is to get back to the how could there be, I think it goes to whether there's an intentional act or an intentional withholding of the information.
Right, but I have a slightly different question, which okay. is why wasn't Mr. Mitchell called as a witness, given that the testimony of the two Metro officers? And should we draw a negative inference from that?
No, I don't believe in it. At the time, and here's the reason why. At the time of the evidentiary hearing, granted, any witness can come in to support or help with or elucidate the court as to information pertaining to what the underlying issue is, in this case, this booklet. Mr. Mitchell stated in the record that he did not remember the booklet, he didn't have the booklet.
Where did he say that?
It is in the transcript. I think it's day 9 and day 10 transcripts.
Okay.
He's talking about the booklet, whether or not, you know, he's clearly surprised. I'm clearly surprised. I've never seen
it. Yeah, I'm not disputing okay. your representations
so,
at all.
So it's in the record. So that's part of it. We get to the evidentiary hearing. I asked specifically, who do you want to have at the evidentiary hearing? They said Detective Whiteley and Detective Ford, and they were going to bring in Don Campbell to prove that they had actually provided this to the court. Now, that was the state of things. Scott Mitchell wasn't there in the courtroom at the time. We just didn't call him. Those were the witnesses that we believed were necessary to come forward. In retrospect, yes, bring forward Scott Mitchell. But he had already stated what he had his belief was. It's not, I don't believe there's a reasonable belief on my part that his, I mean, I've worked with him for a lot of years.
But on day 9, he wasn't under oath. At the evidentiary hearing, exactly. He would have been under oath.
That's a big difference. There's a difference there with being under oath versus not under oath.
Representations of the trial counsel is meaningless because you're not under oath. But it means a lot at an evidentiary hearing when you raise your hand and swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And he wasn't there.
Wasn't there, right?
And as a defense attorney for a number of years, I never, the DA never was satisfied with who I wanted at an evidentiary hearing. They made that decision, not the defense attorney. So I don't know where you're coming from on that, Stuller.
Well,
the only issue is requesting detectives and not requesting Scott Mitchell. I mean, Mitchell was an important witness in this whole thing. This is a big deal. You know, when you're in trial for that many days, and maybe the defense felt they were going pretty good, and then all of a sudden, this happens. It's a catastrophe. And then the defendant has to face trial again. It's very traumatic from a defense standpoint of view. And that's why Mitchell should have at least testified under oath at the evidentiary hearing, as far as I'm concerned.
That may well be the case. And in retrospect, I think I would have called him. And if this court were to order a remand and any additional remedies that might be in a new evidentiary hearing, I would call him as an expert witness, or not an expert witness, but as a witness to deal with this. I know what the answer
to your explanation. What were the circumstances under which he was making representations to the court on pages 9, or on day 9 and 10?
What were the circumstances?
Yeah, how did he happen to be in court and making those representations?
Well, he was the prosecutor in the case.
Right. So where did he go when the evidentiary hearing took place?
He was no longer in the office. He had retired.
I see.
So, I mean, it's not impossible to get him back, obviously, to testify if we needed to. That was something that, in retrospect, should have been done. But the reason I flesh out the background is to show that this is not something that we held clandestinely. When we called the police, I called the police that night. I was told by the court to do so. Called the police that night to find out what about this booklet. Detective Ford knew about the booklet. Went back to Metro Intel where they had originally the materials and found the booklet, but it was not contained in the materials with the materials that they had brought over before. It was on a shelf separate and apart because it was a part of an investigation that didn't go anywhere from their perspective. So it was isolated from it. And that's why when I asked him, do you specifically remember providing this to Scott Mitchell, to giving it over to him? He said no, he did not. He believed he would have, but he did not remember doing it. Since it was separate and apart from the materials that I had requested to bring over to the court, over for counsel and myself, but prior to trial, I don't know that that's an accurate rendition. I know the court has to deal with what the record is. And the record says that there was a finding that the materials were exculpatory, there was a Brady violation, and they were not turned over. However, there was also two findings, both at the time this went down and also after the evidentiary hearing, that there was no intent, no intentionality by the state.
Please finish your statement.
By the state in turning over this information. Because of that lack of intentionality, I think that the court, if it follows the precedent in Oregon versus Kennedy and Melchor Gloria, that this would not bar a retrial on double jeopardy grounds. And because this court has already dismissed count one, the ultimate cure of not going forward on that count has already been addressed and can't be brought forth in the actual trial itself, other than relation to this one administrative clarification in Mr. Thomas's actions post contract and what he did with the contract.
Thank you. So your point, may I have one point?
Yes.
Your point is that under Oregon versus Kennedy, given the finding of lack of intentionality and no finding of goading into moving for a mistrial, you would not have a double jeopardy problem because the defendant, in essence, consented to the mistrial by moving for it.
That's absolutely correct. And I know this court, and I listened to the prior arguments before coming here, and I've listened to the questions and answers today by both myself and counsel and the court, and I've not yet heard one substantive thing that says that a book that wasn't turned over months, years before, at the time of trial, 10 days into the trial, when defense counsel had it for 4 days, that somehow that goaded them into requesting mistrial. If the court would look at the record as to those days up to the the actual asking of mistrial, which was day 10, not day 9 when this comes up. There was never a mention of mistrial at that time by counsel or exculpatory evidence that was withheld or Brady violation or anything else, that there's no evidence and actually a very strong underpinning that there was actually no goading. There was no sort of forcing the defense into a mistrial, something they strategically decided to ask for day 10 after they'd gone back and looked at things. I'm sorry.
Any other questions, colleagues?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the trial was going well for the defense. It was going so well that the repeated questions to Mr. Mitchell during the trial, of what is your theory? What's the criminality? Is entering into a bad business contract a felony in Nevada? Repeated throughout the trial. And it resulted, the reason you know that the judge really meant that is that before you reversed him, he kicked the whole case out, finding that there was a failure to state a crime because he felt he was so uncertain that they had proved anything that was criminal in this case.
I don't want to derail you on the double jeopardy, but I would like to hear about your argument with respect to the other counts.
The other claim in the petition. I sent you in a supplemental citation to authorities the McDonald case because of, and we had originally cited Skilling, which is this whole area of honest services fraud. When you look at the facts in McDonald, what happens here? What happened here is not anywhere close, and yet the Supreme Court threw out Governor McDonald's conviction, and it was a slightly different theory. But the concern, which I've cited in the supplemental authority, which is in the case, about leaving everything up to the prosecutor's discretion. I should note here that in response to the questions on the double jeopardy, and so what we're asking you to do, let me just finish with that thought, what we're asking you to do is, because what's happened is I have nothing to take to the U.S. Supreme Court. The only decision I have on the issue of vagueness, which is what the concern of the U.S. Supreme Court was, the only order I have is I won in the district court. When you decided the issue that the prosecutor framed up, and that's where you decided the issue, you decided it as a notice issue in the indictment, and there was no ruling at all that the statute is vague or not vague, or that there's a crime or there isn't a crime with these facts. So we're just asking for the ability to have an order on that so that we can test this. It's a very, very hot issue, these political corruption cases in which you've got prosecutor holding all the discretion. I do want to cite you to Appendix 109, which is where the judge goes through the reasons, and I don't have much time left, but he goes through the reasons why the failure to turn over the exculpatory material was prejudicial to the rest of the case. It's on page 109 of the appendix at the time of the granting of the mistrial. Mr. Mitchell had retired from the DA's office. I can't help but note that Mr. Stoddard has also retired from the DA's office. So when they want somebody back, they want to put him on a special contract to do work that is already being done by the DA's office, which, by the way, was the theory underlying counts 1 and 6, that there were people already doing the work and that Mr. Thomas was contracting people to do the work they were already being done. DA's office can bring Mr. Stoddard here. They could have brought Mr. Mitchell here, and then we might. But just finally on that note, the fact of the matter is that when the judge found what he found because of Detective Ford's response to the question of the disc from Don Campbell, is that what you're talking about? Was that turned over? Detective Ford said to the court, yes, that's what was turned over long prior to the trial. Clearly, the trial court judge heard Mr. Mitchell's representations on day 9. The trial court judge must not have believed him in order to make the finding that the items were in the possession of the DA. Thank you, Your Honor.
Colleagues, any other questions? Okay. Thank you both very much for your arguments today and the briefing, and the matter will stand.